Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And Paris, you know, has always been associated with fine dining. Whether you think of the sidewalk cafes or a smoky bistro and a sultry chanteuse, romance, fine food, even throughout history, there have been monarchs, marriages, murder, intrigue, and fine dining. Whatever the period of time, it is an indisputable fact that Parisians have a long-standing love affair with food, contagious to anyone who visits. And my guest today, David Downey, definitely caught the bug and dove headfirst into the food and history of Paris. David moved to Paris in the mid-80s and became a travel, food, and arts writer, with features appearing in many of the leading publications, such as Gourmet, Saveur, Go and Mio. David divides his time between France and Italy. It's a tough life, but someone has to do it. And David is the author of over a dozen nonfiction books, including Paris, Paris, and A Passion for Paris. His newest book, out next week, is a must for anyone going to Paris and anyone with an interest in food and history. Big hint, he gives walking tours of Paris. The book is called A Taste of Paris, A History of the Parisian Love Affair with Food. And joining me by phone from Paris, welcome, David.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, you say...
I mean, here and there.
Well, you know, kind of here. But you say that this, you've written this book and that it is, you don't want to have people shy away thinking it's too much history. And you do give some nice, you know, good, deep, heavy history in there. But you like to refer to it more as a romp through Paris, weaving past and present?
Yes, because I think that the past is present in Paris. Paris is a very old city, as I'm sure you and all of your listeners know. And everywhere you go, you find the past living. And that's what's so wonderful about it for me, because I'm a history buff. And I just love the living layers of history. You get that in the food. For example, tonight I am going to be eating a historic dish. Very, very complicated, very sophisticated, and I bet you could guess what it is, but I'm going to save you the trouble and tell you. It's poule au pot, and that is basically chicken in a pot.
Well, you know,
do you remember
just...
Henry the Fourth, King Henry the Fourth, who famously said that every inhabitant of France deserved a chicken in the pot?
A chicken in every
pot.
That
was 400 years ago, and it's still a very popular dish, and that's what I'm making right now.
Okay, so you beg the question, why Paris? Why are Parisians so passionate about their food?
Because food became an intellectual activity, hedonism, eating were both intellectualized over 200 years ago. So food was not just about eating and about getting enough calories to stay warm and function through the day. It wasn't just fuel. There were two theorists, food theorists, the people who really developed the notion of gastronomy, la gastronomie, and they were both born in the 18th century during the reign of Louis the 15th. They came into their own during the reign of Louis the 16th, grew up sort of about the time we had our revolution in America, and then really founded the science of gastronomy. It was considered a science just after the French Revolution. And I'm talking about Grimaud de la Reynière, which is not an easy name, and most people don't know it, and Briard Savarin, and most people do know Briard Savarin, although possibly not pronounced that way, because the Savarin cake, the sponge cake, was named after him.
Right.
So these two guys really turned eating and entertaining, dining, into an intellectual art. It became very hip, and it wasn't considered mere gluttony anymore. And that sort of shaped the way the middle and upper classes thought about food, and it lives on today. Briard Savarin's book, by the way, which is called The Physiology of Taste in English, La Physiologie du Goût in French, has never been out of print. And it was published in the 1820s, and it has never been out of print.
All right, and it's a must-read for anyone in the field of food and gastronomy, truly.
I would say for anyone, period. It's beautifully written. It's fascinating. And one of the things that I like most about it, beyond the writing, which is just beautiful, is the way this man, Briard Savarin, anticipated and intuited all kinds of things that modern science learned decades or a century after he died.
Interesting. And you speak also of Grimaud de la Reynière, and he, in fact, was like what we would, I guess, consider the first restaurant review writer as well. Was he not?
Yes, that's right. He wrote the first restaurant reviews and also the first restaurant guidebooks. You have to bear in mind that the restaurant as we know it today, meaning an a la carte restaurant where you sit at your own table and order things off of a menu, was born in Paris in the 1760s. There were no restaurants before that. There were taverns, and there were inns, and there were all sorts of places where you could eat, but they weren't called restaurants, and they didn't offer a la carte dining. Now, we take that for granted, right? You think, well, what's so revolutionary about sitting down in a restaurant and ordering a meal? But before the restaurant, or in, as it was known in the beginning, the restaurateur, you basically sat at a tavern table, a shared table, often a big table, and you didn't know what you were going to eat, and you had to struggle for it. And the quality of the food wasn't necessarily great. The decor was pretty minimal. And then suddenly, with the rise and rise of the bourgeoisie, we're talking about the heyday of Madame de Pompadour and so on, who made being bourgeois chic. Suddenly, someone came up with this idea of creating a restaurant that looked like a nobleman's house or a dining room, mm-hmm. and where you were served by discreet waiters. You could sit at your own table, and you had a la carte items with a price attached. And this was all very, very new and revolutionary. Yeah. So Grimaud de la Reynière came along. He was born about the time the restaurant was born. And during the French Revolution, and primarily after it, but the revolution extended, the revolutionary period extended from 1789 to 1799. That's 10 years. By the time it was over, Grimaud de la Reynière was reviewing these restaurants and putting together his first guidebook, which came out in 1802, I believe, the first edition of it. So he was really the forerunner of all restaurant critics and guidebook writers.
All right. Well, and it took a while for Americans to catch up, for sure. But interestingly enough, just this year, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, Delmonico's here in New York City celebrated its 180th anniversary. And as the first fine dining restaurant in America, and of course fashioned after the French style, the restaurant, and with French menus and recipes. And so, but it took a good, 80 years after the start of the restaurant in Paris before that happened. So it's interesting that it was born and started in Paris, and it took a while to catch on in other major cities.
Yes, it did.
But even before then, you even mentioned in your book that for a historical perspective, you don't have to look much further than Rome for the cuisine. Greeks, Romans, when do you feel that really the French, before being codified in writing for recipes, but when do you feel French cuisine was born?
I would say that specifically French cuisine, as opposed to court cuisine or the papal cuisine, mm-hmm. Which was eaten all over Europe, it really came into its own in the 17th century,
as you 1600s, mentioned. Okay.
And specifically under Louis XIV at Versailles and in Paris. He went back and forth until the 1680s when he moved out to Versailles permanently. So the cradle of French gastronomy is Paris and Versailles. But as you said, the ancient Roman influence is there. The French still eat many ancient Roman specialties without knowing it, and others do too, the Italians, obviously. And I'll toss out just a few of the ones that everyone thinks of and everyone associates with France. Escargot, never heard of snails? Well, the Romans were wild about snails, and they still are. No one talks about the Italians eating snails because the French took over, and I guess escargot sounds better than lumaca, which sounds like a slug, which is the same
word. But it is, right.
How about frog's legs? Well, there's an entire chapter in Apicius's late imperial era cookbook about how to cook frogs. Mustard, everyone thinks mustard comes from Dijon, right? No, ancient Rome brought mustard to France. And on and on. And then the killer one that makes the French squirm, they absolutely can't stand this if you remind them, is foie gras.
Foie gras, of course. Right.
Foie gras is fegato grasso, but the ancient Romans didn't invent it. They perfected it, Apicius again. It's actually ancient Egyptian, and no one knows how old it is. And it was made by the Jews in antiquity, In fact, they may have introduced it to Egypt during the captivity. It's unknown. The Greeks picked it up. The Romans picked it up. So foie gras has been around for a very long time. And I could go on, but there are many, many things that you eat in France today and in Paris that have been eaten here for the last 2,000 years or more.
Well, and I like how you say that, you know, you have to look no further than Rome, but it was all part of the Roman Empire, so that all kind of makes sense anyway.
Indeed, Paris was a fairly important city. It wasn't a really important city. Lyon, today's Lyon, was the capital of Gaul. It was much, much bigger. And Reims, where the cathedral is, the famous cathedral, mm-hmm. was also huge and much more important than Paris. So was Orléans. Paris happened to prosper more than the others I've just named in the Middle Ages, and it became the seat of royalty in the Middle Ages, and it really has been the center of French life for probably about 900 years.
All right. Well, so many of the feasts, of course, the food of the courts, as you mentioned before, a lot of those feasts have been recorded as a budgetary matter, if nothing else. But also in art, although we hate to look to art to get true representation, but at that period, prior to the 18th century, it was probably pretty accurate. And many of the tapestries are representations of feasts. And you mentioned that as well, especially at the... Well, go on. You talk.
Yeah, no, there are lots of representations of food from antiquity that are very accurate and very beautiful. Lots of Roman mosaics, for example. Mm-hmm. And, yes, in tapestries, there are some absolutely beautiful tapestries in Paris that a lot of people will have heard of, the Lady and the Unicorn series, for example. Mm-hmm. They're Renaissance tapestries. They're from the 1500s, and they're hanging in the Musée de Cluny, which is the National Museum of the Middle Ages in Paris. And they represent the senses, and if you look carefully, you will see all sorts of edible things in them, because the senses are obviously about eating it, but also smelling and seeing and touching and so forth. And in one of them, there are dozens and dozens of medicinal plants and plants that were used for cooking. There are also lots of treatises, cookbooks, collections of recipes, put it that way. Quite a lot is known about what people ate. There are plenty of inventories, or even a lot of menus left over. And then there are a number of very precious late medieval cookbooks. And I talk about one in detail in the book, my book. And it was compiled, I'm not going to say written, but let's say compiled in the 1390s by a celebrity cook, the first French celebrity cook, whose name was Taillevent. That wasn't his real name, but everyone called him Taillevent. And as many of your listeners will know, probably the most famous and longest-lived great restaurant in Paris is called Le Taillevent. It's been around for, 50 years or something, 60 maybe. Mm-hmm. And so it honors Taillevent. There was a notion of French cooking in the Middle Ages, but if you were of the upper classes, you tended to be, actually in a strange way, very European as opposed to very French. The notion of France and the monarchy was not the same back then, and it was really with Louis XIV who finished the task of destroying feudalism in France and creating this gigantic kingdom, that you also get the notion of French food.
Yeah, well, that it's only, I mean, it's understandable from reading, you know, about the different marriages between the countries that, and the somehow the French food always prevailed, and how one talks about the type of service, you know, at courts in the French, of course, service à la Russe was the big change, right? And you talked about, you talk a lot about the service à la Française, which I don't even think was a French thing. Was that everything being brought out at once, but in small portions, kind of like at a grab bag table, and, as opposed to being brought out in courses, right?
And so, a banquet. We still get them today. I mean, you've been to a banquet, except probably. In America, the banquets that I went to, everything was brought out at once. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Renaissance banquets in France and Italy, these courses with up to 20, 30 different dishes would be brought out, and those would be put around, and people would pick at them. Generally, you know, if you had 30 different dishes, you would have a small serving of each one of them placed within arm's reach of everyone, especially the important people, and you would just taste. It was like a tasting menu, and then they would whisk away those 30 dishes, and they would bring out another 5 or 10 or 15 or whatever, and these banquets would go on for hours and hours and hours. And this happened in many places in Europe, but the French, because they like to do this, they called that service à la Française. It wasn't particularly French, as you say. And so the other really revolutionary thing that happened at about the same time that Crémaux de la Reynière and Priya Savarin were writing in the very early 1800s, this idea of service à la Russe was introduced. And that is what essentially we have today. That is that a dish was brought in hot, one thing at a time, so that you actually ate hot food. So instead of having all these things piled around you, most of them being congealed and not particularly appealing, you suddenly had this new kind of service. And the Russians introduced that to Paris. Of course, the French, again, being very proud French people, soon adopted it, and now everyone thinks that that was service à la Française. If you ask 100 Frenchmen, I would say that 99 of them, if not 100, think that that was French.
Right. Well, we have a lot more to talk about in terms of fast-forwarding to some not so modern, but not present day. And we will do that as soon as we come back from a short break. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with David Downey. He's the author of a book, actually, to be released next week. I think it's available now if you go online. It's A Taste of Paris, A History of the Parisian Love Affair with Food. And David, you know, it can be very intimidating for a traveler in Paris. It's just part of the sightseeing is going to a market. Everything is so beautifully displayed. And very particular in terms of, you know, what one should choose. The Parisians all seem to be so, is this a natural, innate talent imbued in them? How to choose their food and where to shop for things? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that middle-aged and older Parisians were brought up in a very different world from what we live in today, where food was really a very important part of what you did during the day. Meaning, you'd go out and shop and cook, and then eat together. Obviously, most Frenchmen don't know how to boil an egg, and they still don't today. But food has always been a big part of the culture here, and I'm not sure if it's innate or not. But they also seem to be pretty good with aesthetics and displaying foods to make them appealing. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love London. I have nothing against the English. But when I go to London and I look into shop windows, and I see meat piled up in butcher shops, and it's just unappetizing often. Whereas, as you say, if you go into a French market, especially an open market, each of the stallholders goes out of his way to display things in an attractive way. So it becomes a joy to shop, as long as you're not trampled to death. I mean, outdoor markets can get very lively. The one I go to twice a week to get almost everything I cook is on the Boulevard Richard Lenoir. It's right near the Bastille, the Place de la Bastille. And, you find the most incredible produce that some direct producers, growers of food, including organic produce, and great fishmongers, stalls. There's all kinds of things there, cooked foods, Lebanese street food, and so forth. So it's really part of the daily culture of Paris, because every district, every neighborhood practically has an outdoor market. Right. And they move around. So, there are many, many supermarkets, and you go to the supermarket here, I do, to buy, basic things like aluminum foil and toilet paper and whatnot. But for just about everything else, you go to an open market or you go to a specialized shop, like a butcher shop or a bakery, pastry shop, and so forth. And, there too, everything is beautifully displayed.
It's an art.
You've been to Paris. You see how yes. People dress. They're pretty stylish. compared to most other people.
Right.
I mean, again, the Italians are very stylish and they display things beautifully too, but, you know, they are cousin countries.
That's right. That's right. There is, when I was talking about marriages and monarchs and murder and intrigue in the introduction, I was referring, of course, a lot to the, you know, the marriages from, you know, France and Spain and Italy, ways to combine empires and powers. And
right.
that had a tremendous amount to do with the development of cuisines as well. And France, of course, absorbed it all. And of course, we have to mention Catherine de' Medici and artichokes. It's just one of my favorite stories.
Well, everyone knows that artichokes are the one of the great aphrodisiacs, right?
Right.
At least the Italians believe that. I suspect you're of Italian origin, judging by your last name.
Not I, but it's in my palate.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, my mother is actually Italian, so I grew up eating lots of Italian food. Artichokes, again, another specialty of ancient Rome, but not native to Italy. Artichokes are native to North Africa, believe it or not, and they were brought over by the Romans over 2,000 years ago and coddled and developed. And Caterina de' Medici, who was a Florentine noblewoman, actually she wasn't noble, she was, well, the Medici were not noble at that time, but they were later. She was married off to King Henry II. He wasn't a king at the time. He wasn't even supposed to become a king because he was a younger son. But she was shipped up to Paris, and her husband became King Henry II. So Caterina de' Medici, or Catherine de' Medicis, if you prefer, brought all sorts of things up from Florence. It is said that she introduced the fork to France. The historical record suggests that the fork had actually been brought up a lot earlier than that under Charles V in the 1300s, although it was not adopted and it was just used for serving purposes. She loved marzipan and artichokes and all sorts of things that the French hadn't been eating up to then. And she also insisted on the Italian Renaissance table manners and what the French then call the à la table, which means beautiful dishes and flatware, that kind of thing, ceramic dishes and so forth. So she's credited with certainly enlivening and modernizing French food. But as you know from having read my book, the story is more complicated because that process of the Italianization of French medieval cooking actually started before that. It started around the year 1500 when a very famous Italian cookbook was translated from Latin and Italian into French and was adopted all over France. That was a cookbook with a real mouthful for a title, De Honesta Voluptate, which basically means honest, wholesome voluptuousness.
It was actually health, and it was a health
recipes,
a health book as well.
Latina. The recipes were actually by an Italian cook. He may have been an Italian Swiss. It's not known. Named Maestro or Mastro Martino, and so these recipes were much better crafted and much more useful and digestible than the most of the French medieval repertoire, and so they were adopted widely. There was yet another influence that was before Catherine de' Medici, and that was King Francis I of France, François Premier, who went down to Italy over and over and fought in Italian campaigns and loved Italian food and loved Italian culture. And he is the one who brought, among many, many others, Leonardo da Vinci back up to France to help with military planning and also to improve the state of the arts, because France was stuck in the Middle Ages in many, many ways. So the Italian influence was huge, and it started probably around the year 1500, and it really didn't wane until, again, as I said, the reign of Louis XIV.
Right. Well, in reading your book, and I encourage people who are going to Paris or who have been or who just love to read about great places with great food, I have learned locations of things that, of course, you know, that are historical places that I would never have known about and did not know when I was there. Time for another trip. One in particular was the Bibliothèque Mazarin, which you used, I'm sure, for a lot of your research.
Yes, and again, it's an interesting link to Italy. The Bibliothèque Mazarin is named for Mazarin, whose real name was Mazzarino. He was Italian, and he ran France for a very long time. And anyone who's read The Three Musketeers or 20 years after, you know, the sequel to The Three Musketeers will remember Mazarin, because he's decried as this Italian who is running the country, and he's really villainous in the book. In fact, he may have been villainous. I don't know. I don't want to defend him, but he may have been Louis XIV's genetic father, among other things. He created this college, and it was called it's that beautiful building on the Seine where the Pont des Arts is, and it houses the French Academy and the French Institute, basically the language police, and the Bibliothèque Mazarin, which is the Mazarin Library, which happens to have a copy, one of the original copies of Taizan. And I say copy because they were all copied by hand, so it's a manuscript. And it's in the reserve of reserves. It's practically impossible to see it, but I managed after months and months of pleading with them, and they brought it out. So I was very excited to see that, and lots of other historic cookbooks and food, you know, books about food. So, yeah, it's a fabulous place. So it's a real treasure trove for gastronomes.
So many pieces of history I learned that you kind of filled the gaps in there for me in so many, and explained so many of the transfers of power and what was going on. And it was very, very intriguing for me. And then, of course, you get to the other senses, wine, food, and sex, as you refer to it, the Holy Trinity, which I thought was brilliant. Of course, Paris is known for this too, as I mentioned, the sidewalk cafes or the smoky bistros, and it's just all part of the whole Parisian intrigue. You know, the food, wine, and romance. Is there any particular instance that you feel kind of started this whole thing?
I think that the association of food and romance or sex, to be more straightforward, began during the Regency after the death of Louis XIII and Louis 17th was very young, so his great uncle ran the realm, Philippe d'Orléans, who owned the Palais Royal that we all know about, and he sort of initiated these intimate dinners that you know, the sort of orgies of food and debauchery and sex. In fact, the word rouer that we still use in English for someone who's really debauched came from the Palais Royal and the people, the partiers who went to his dinner parties. And then it penetrated the middle classes, the bourgeoisie that really came into its own during the time of Madame de Pompadour in the mid-1700s when Louis XV was fully grown and ready to go. He became a great hedonist and ate immense amounts of food and galloped around and slept with countless mistresses. And it sort of got into the French blood. And then in the 19th century, with the rise and rise of the bourgeoisie, when Paris really became the capital of the civilized world, at least the Western world, the restaurant was one of the places where you would take your mistress. It didn't go the other way most of the time. It was almost always men taking their lady friends to restaurants that had special private rooms. There's still a number of restaurants around that physically exist from that period. But as far as I know, that kind of thing doesn't go on anymore. But you can actually go into restaurants today. The Grand Verrier at the Palais Royal, which is probably Paris's most beautiful restaurant from the late 18th century, still has an upstairs area. The Escargot Montorgueil, which is getting on 200 years old at this point, also has an upstairs, and it stopped at Victor Hugo. He'd take his mistresses up there. There are a number of others that I described in the book. So this association of food and philandering and sex and so on really took root. For the middle classes in the 19th century. And again, you know, my last book, the book that came out before this, was A Passion for Paris, and it's about the links between the Romantic Age and Paris today. And the French, the Parisians in particular, in many ways still live in the 19th century. Paris is no longer caput mundi, right? I mean, New York is much bigger and more powerful and richer. Beijing, London even, and so on. But Paris still is this wonderful, beautiful, romantic city with tens of thousands of buildings from centuries past, including many, many old restaurants.
You know, I would be remiss if I ended this program without mentioning Escoffier. Now, you have a wonderful quote in the end, towards the end of the book. You said, "If Escoffier had not existed, someone French would have had to invent him." Just elaborate on that for us, if you will.
Well, Escoffier was not the first, but certainly the greatest missionary of French cuisine and of sort of chauvinistic French nationalism when it came to cooking. He actually stole all that from Carême, who had been the great bridging chef between the Ancien Régime, the pre-revolutionary times, and the Napoleonic era and the restoration of the monarchy. So along comes Escoffier 50, 60, 70 years later. He came into his own, and he developed really he perfected the notion of the grand tables and the huge luxury hotel and restaurant. So he teamed up with César Ritz, as in the Ritz Hotel, and he then exported French cooking, or his version of it, which was kind of wow food, again, that he borrowed mostly from Carême and other chefs who may have been better chefs than he was. He was a very talented self-promoter, and reminds me a great deal of certain superstar French chefs today. If you can't, I'm happy to say that I think that we wouldn't have an Alain Ducasse today without an Escoffier nearly 100 years ago.
Right, and he was, as you said, he was a champion at championing the French cuisine, and that's I thought that was a very interesting thing for you to say, that a French person would have had to invent him, just because he did as much as he did a lot for the French cuisine in that regard, is that he brought it to the rest of the world, undoubtedly. There are so many other wonderful pieces of history and pieces of the past, pieces that live on, restaurants, markets, food, cafes. Oh, it's just, as you know, of course, as a tourist, we look at it as more of a hedonistic, as you mentioned, you know, venture. We're there to party and play. And with a guide like you and a book like this, it makes it even more fun. And that's David Downey. And the book is A Taste of Paris, A History of the Parisian Love Affair with Food. And I might mention that David has a website, David D. Downey, DOWNIE.com. And also ParisParisTours.com. So, David, it was certainly a pleasure to talk with you about this book, and I encourage people to pick it up and use it, read it, take it with you in your suitcase if you're going to Paris. Thanks so much.
Yeah, many thanks. It's been great talking to you.
Okay, and thanks for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El-Waeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.